طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly 45-minute segment of news from Palestine and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal military occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program presents news and analysis from the Palestinian perspective, a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. We ask our listeners, as we do every week, were you involved last week in the Palestine-Israel peace movement and the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's savage military attacks against them to force them out of their homes and annex their properties into Israel? Did you speak out on the atrocities Israel is committing every day in Gaza and the West Bank? If not, why not? What is your reason not to? We regret having to start at an earlier hour, but it allows us to return to our usual 45-minute format instead of the shortened half-hour version we had last week. Today is Sunday, July 26, 2009. We begin with a summary of news highlights and commentary. A little over a month ago, we were treated to the opening of a heavily choreographed theatrical play called Settlement Freeze. The first scene featured President Obama's famous speech in Cairo, where he was reported in the media to have called for a freeze on settlement construction. What he actually called for was the end of new settlement construction. The old saying, caveat emptor, or buyer beware, warning consumers of swindler salesmen, applies most especially to swindler politicians. It's all out there in a vanishingly small fine print of mumbled words. The end of new settlement construction does not mean the end of all settlement construction, and it certainly does not mean the dismantling of settlements, all of which are illegal under international law. Scene 2 of the play featured a press conference following a meeting between Secretary Clinton and Israeli Foreign Minister Lieberman on June 17th, during which Secretary Clinton, with Mr. Lieberman standing at her side, told reporters, quote, "We want to see a stop to the settlements," end of quote. Mr. Lieberman, who himself lives in the illegal settlement of Nokdim in the West Bank, predictably retorted that he finds this vision unacceptable. The novelty in the scene is that the exchange occurred in public, intending to make us believe that there was real tension between the United States and Israel. That so-called tension was publicly reenacted when Secretary Clinton summoned Israel's new ambassador over last weekend to ask for clarifications of an Israeli plan to construct new housing units in East Jerusalem. The housing is being financed by California multimillionaire Irving Moskowitz, using the proceeds he is siphoning off his so-called charity bingo operation at the Hawaiian Gardens on the outskirts of Los Angeles. On Monday, July 20th, Israeli Vice Premier Sylvan Shalom publicly declared that Jerusalem is the eternal capital of Israel and that the demand not to build in Jerusalem is unacceptable. Other actors joined in this theater of the absurd: the United Nations, the European Union, and Russia, all publicly chanting settlement freeze to make us believe that the world community might be waking up at last. Not on your life. Last Monday, July 20th, the Jerusalem Post reported that the Council of Europe's European Court of Human Rights recently upheld the French ruling, making it illegal and discriminatory to boycott Israeli goods, and that making it illegal to call for a boycott of Israeli goods did not constitute a violation of one's freedom of expression. Really. So where is all this heading? Was all that projected tension really pure theater? Was it an expression of Israel's confidence in the sickeningly sycophantic U.S. Congress that it could visibly defy the United States president with impunity? Was it a play on President Obama's part to regain the image of honest broker? Or was there some heavy-duty behind-the-scenes winking between the parties? Frankly, we believe the latter is true. We expect Special Envoy George Mitchell to inform Palestinian President Abbas any day that despite earnest efforts, the United States is unable to pressure Israel into stopping settlement construction, and would Mr. Abbas please resume negotiations with Israel while settlement construction continued, and that might even be sweetened with a bribing offer of more monetary aid to the PA. As the temperature rose by the public exchange over settlements, Israel's foreign minister instructed all Israeli embassies and consulates to hang a 1940s picture of the then Grand Mufti of Jerusalem sitting with Hitler in a clear attempt to smear the Palestinians and muster public support for Israel. But let's get our facts straight. While it is true that the Grand Mufti appealed to Hitler in desperation of watching the Zionist British alliance rape his country, let us remember that former Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir, who was then the operations commander of the notorious terrorist group of thugs known as the Stern Gang, who were responsible for many massacres of Palestinians, sent two emissaries to Beirut to meet with German agents and offer the services of the Zionist military to Nazi Germany. Evidence of that meeting was found in the archives of the German embassy in Turkey. In fact, there is a long documented history of Zionist collaboration with Nazi Germany. If you are interested in learning more about it, we recommend the book entitled 51 Documents, Zionist Collaboration with the Nazis by Leni Brenner. The book is available from Amazon.com. Israel continued its increasingly shrill public relations campaign by having Haaretz, Israel's most influential newspaper, publish a breathtakingly lunatic article being circulated in a booklet published by the Union of Orthodox Congregations of America, accusing the Pope and the Cardinals of the Vatican of teaching Hezbollah how to kill Jews. At the same time, the government wiped out all mention of the Nakba in the books in Israel, as if that would erase all memory of the barbaric massacres and armed expulsions its Zionist founders were responsible for. We have mentioned more than once in this program and elsewhere that Israel's actions endanger Jews everywhere, and that the anti-Semitism that will likely erupt when the world wakes up to the enormity of Israel's crimes will make Inquisition anti-Semitism pale by comparison. Sadly, we are beginning to see the faint rumblings of it. A report from the United States State Department details an upsurge across the world of anti-Semitism, hostility and discrimination toward Jewish people. The report also details physical acts of anti-Semitism such as attacks, property damage, and cemetery desecration. Mention has also been made of wanton attacks of vandalism carried out by Zionist fanatics in Paris. Meanwhile, the Judaization of East Jerusalem continues unabated. Israel has reduced the tariff of essential Israel has reduced the traffic of essential goods into Gaza to some 60 trucks per day, compared to 400 trucks before the siege, and has threatened to close all crossing points on Friday. In the West Bank, Israeli soldiers seized 14 Palestinian civilians around Tulkarem and Nablus. And in the town of Beit Sahur in the district of Bethlehem, Israeli soldiers forcibly removed international activists from a hilltop and ushered in a group of settlers. The Palestinian political landscape was thrown in turmoil this month when the much-respected Mr. Farouk al-Qaddoumi, one of the few surviving founders of the PLO, alleged during a press conference in Amman, Jordan on July 12th that the current Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas and his strongman Mahmoud Dahlan were privy to the assassination of the late PLO chairman and former PA president Yasser Arafat in November 2004. Mr. Qaddoumi, who is currently the Secretary General of Fatah Central Committee, repeated the accusation during an interview with Al Jazeera, whereupon Mr. Abbas kicked the Al Jazeera news agency out of the West Bank, only to reinstate it shortly thereafter. The authenticity and many details of Mr. Qaddoumi's documents, audio tapes, and minutes supporting his allegation have not been sorted out. But his high standing and importance in political circles lend considerable weight and credence to his pronouncements, in spite of the smearing and character assassination campaigns launched against him by Abbas loyalists within the PLO. We have seen a heavy traffic of proposals to deal with the situation, including establishing a ruling council and various re-election structures. So far, however, no arrangements have been made for the presidential and parliamentary elections, which by law are scheduled to take place in January 2010. All eyes are now focused on Fatah's 6th Congress, scheduled to be held in Bethlehem on August the 4th, where the party will determine whether to give Mr. Abbas a free pass or challenge his leadership and risk breaking apart. Interestingly, Mr. Qaddoumi, who now lives in Lebanon, and all his allies who live outside the West Bank may not be allowed to enter the West Bank. It is not every day that we have some uplifting news to report. Our featured guest today, Mr. Jeff Klein, participated in the United States convoy to Gaza, which formally left the United States on July 4th and broke the siege of Gaza. Jeff is retired president of a local labor union who lives in Dorchester. He has been active around the issue of Palestinian freedom for many years, hosting Palestinian trade unionists in Boston and traveling to Palestine and Israel 5 times since 2003. Jeff speaks frequently on the Palestine-Israel conflict in schools, churches, mosques, and to community groups. He returned last week after participating in the United States Viva Palestina convoy, the largest single U.S. solidarity delegation to Palestine, which succeeded in cracking the Israeli-Egyptian U.S. blockade to bring medical and humanitarian relief supplies into Gaza. He joins us now by telephone. Good morning, Jeff Klein.
Good morning, Sharif.
You arrived late Tuesday night. I hope you have shaken off the jet lag.
Well, some, but not completely, I have to say.
I bet. Tell us about your adventures with the convoy and the many obstacles you encountered. Most of the convoy participants gathered in New York City on July 3rd and flew to Cairo on July 4th and 5th. How many people were there? The convoy, was it led by British parliamentarian George Holloway? Were there any American Palestinians among the group? Tell us about that.
Yes, well, for those of us around Boston who have been active in this issue for a long time, this convoy and the organization behind it were a real departure, something that we haven't seen locally. The George Galloway, as you mentioned, a British member of Parliament, and his staff were the prime organizers of it. And their approach was to go directly to the Arab and particularly Palestinian American communities around the U.S., more or less bypassing the solidarity networks that have grown up, the progressive solidarity networks, and going to the grassroots in communities with large Arab populations. And in the months leading up to this convoy, he crisscrossed the country and spoke to large meetings of principally Palestinians in Southern California, Chicago, Detroit, Northern New Jersey, and New York, especially Brooklyn. And so this thing welled up from the grassroots in a way that we haven't typically seen in the solidarity movement. And the 200 people, more or less, who participated in the convoy, my estimation is that about between two-thirds and three-quarters of them were Palestinian Americans and other Arabs, but mostly Palestinians. And it was mostly young, too. I would say the preponderance of participants were kids, young professionals from their 30s down to students in their teens.
What happened when you arrived in Cairo?
As your listeners know, Sharif, Gaza has been under siege by Israel since at least 2004, but more extremely since the elections that brought Hamas government to power in the Hamas leadership, I should say, in the Palestinian Authority in 2006. But it's important to emphasize that the Israeli siege would be impossible to maintain without the cooperation of Egypt in the first place, and also at least the looking the other way of the international community, including the United States. You your readers can probably picture Gaza. It's a strip of land about 20 miles long, with surrounded on two sides, on its two land sides, by Israel, and the Mediterranean Sea on the west, and a short border at Rafah with Egypt that's not controlled directly by Israel. So in order to maintain the siege of Gaza and the sort of near starvation of Gaza, the cooperation of the Egyptians is essential to Israel. And they, in fact, do cooperate with the siege. And we learned this directly. The Egyptians put up one bureaucratic obstacle after another to our effort, which was basically to bring medical relief supplies into Gaza. And that was the chief obstacle. The whole project was daunting from a sort of financial and organizational point of view, but all of that was overcome. The chief difficulty was the bureaucratic and security obstacles put up by the Egyptian government, and we should say with no help at all from the U.S. government. In fact, the collaboration, as far as we could tell, of the U.S. government with the Egyptians in trying to hinder this effort.
You also had the Egyptian military following you everywhere you went, didn't you?
Well, of course, there were undercover plainclothes security operatives that were at the hotel we stayed at in Cairo, and that were on every bus and truck that we use. And of course, they were there in theory officially for our protection, although it's not clear who they were protecting us from. Logically, they were there to keep tabs on us and watch us. Sharif, I know your background is Egyptian. Egypt is an incredibly heavy police state, basically. Not very many Americans know about this, but you can't turn around anywhere in Egypt. Police are everywhere in Egypt, uniform police. And as far as we can understand, police in plain clothes are everywhere. And, of course, it's not a very democratic place, and yet they receive $2 billion of aid from the U.S. every year while we talk about wanting democracy in the Middle East. On the other hand, the Hamas majority in the Palestinian Legislative Council, which was elected in 2006 in what all observers consider the freest election in the Middle East, was immediately repudiated, not only by Israel, but by the U.S. and the international community, because in this free election, the Palestinians didn't vote the way we wanted them to vote. So it's an irony that we boycott a democratically elected administration in Palestine, and we support financially and politically essentially a dictatorship in Egypt.
Yes, the police are everywhere, and the police are in colleges. They are there to prevent public gatherings. No demonstrations on public property is allowed. Only in private property, and even there, demonstrations in colleges, which on college grounds, which are supposed to be private grounds, even there, demonstrations are not allowed. But going beyond this, you were in Alexandria. You went to Alexandria to purchase vehicles, and you purchased some, I believe, 47 vehicles in Alexandria, and you were trying to get them out of the the harbor. What happened there? Did they impound those vehicles?
Yeah, effectively, yes. I mean, let me backtrack a little bit to explain the logistics of this project, which were very complex. I mean, a lot of aid was brought physically with us from the United States in the plane two flights, which were used by people coming directly from New York. Mm-hmm. There were wheelchairs, walkers, blankets, and other medical supplies that were actually packed with the convoy participants on the planes to Cairo. And then the other part of the plan was to gather relief supplies in Egypt, some which had already been prepositioned there by international aid organizations and were refused entry so far. mm-hmm. others which we gathered as donations, and there was a real outpouring of support from Egyptian civil society for this. There were donations from medical groups, dental groups, and so on, and then also to purchase medical supplies in Egypt, because one of the projects of this effort was to raise money in the United States, and they raised over $1 million. And then we were going to transport this this material aid via trucks and cars that we purchased in the duty-free port in Alexandria. You know, in Egypt, as in most countries, there's a very heavy tax on imported vehicles. But we had arranged to buy vehicles in the free port of Alexandria. And then because we were driving them directly out of the country, we would get them without paying this tax. And all this was arranged by lawyers and businessmen and so on. So when we arrived, after a couple of days in Cairo, the members of the convoy split. I was with the group that went to Alexandria, which was intending to pick up the vehicles. The rest of the group stayed in Cairo and continued to gather relief supplies. And the plan was we were going to get the vehicles in Alexandria and meet up with the Cairo contingent in Al-Arish, which is in the Sinai, on the shore, on the way to Gaza, and that we were going to unite there and form the convoy and go to Rafah. Well, when we arrived at the port of Alexandria, we had already bought these vehicles. It was about at the cost of about $500,000. There was one bureaucratic obstacle after another to get them out of the port. And in fact, eventually, after fruitless negotiations, we were not able to get those vehicles out of the port. But we basically had to cool our heels for several days in Alexandria while we were trying to make this happen. Meanwhile, the group from Cairo had finished their collection of relief supplies, and they got on buses and trucks and were heading toward Al-Arish, which, if you can picture it, of course, is you have to cross the Suez Canal to get into Sinai. And the whole of Sinai is regarded by Egypt as a security zone. You can't just drive to Sinai. You have to cross the Suez Canal, and there are checkpoints, effectively, ironically, very much like the Israeli checkpoints that some of us know in the West Bank. There are checkpoints before you can cross the Suez Canal, and the buses from Cairo to Al-Arish were stopped at the canal. And there was a kind of standoff there for 8 hours, all through one of the nights, until eventually they were turned back to Cairo.
Were turned back to Cairo because you were told that you had to supply a list of the participants, which you already had done so.
That's right. It was all, and I'll get to some of the other specifics too, but it was all a concerted effort to delay and effectively run out the clock. Because people had to return, the people with jobs and students and so on had to return, and the theoretical end point of the convoy was July 17th, when most of the people had booked tickets out of Egypt. So it was really an effort to sort of delay things long enough so that the effort would collapse. Meanwhile, we were seeking the help of the U.S. Embassy in Cairo to help facilitate this. We had some fairly significant figures along with us. We had George Galloway, a member of parliament from Britain. We had a New York City councilor, Charles Barron, who did yeoman work in organizing the convoy and helping us politically in Egypt. And then we were joined by Cynthia McKinney, who some of your readers may know had just been released from an Israeli jail after attempting to break the convoy by sea.
Yes.
In a ship that was basically pirated by the Egyptians.
On the Spirit of Humanity, yes.
Yes. She had been released from jail a few days before, flown back to the United States, and immediately turned around and flew to join us in Cairo while we were trying to sort of break the bureaucratic blockade. And so all of these people were in touch with the White House and the State Department, and we thought for a while it looked like there would be some help forthcoming. We were told we all had to report to the U.S. Embassy in Cairo, including those of us who were in Alexandria, so we had to turn around and come back to Cairo to see the consul there. And what it turned out, we were told that we all had to appear in person to sign an affidavit. Essentially, instead of getting help from the U.S. Embassy, we had to sign an affidavit that said we understood. Here's the full affidavit. It's quite remarkable. I have read and understood the travel warning issued by the U.S. Department of State regarding travel to the Gaza Strip. I assume the risk for myself, and I understand the embassy does not recommend my travel to the Gaza Strip. I also understand that the embassy cannot provide me with consular services in Gaza. This is what we were made to sign, and by the way, each of us had to pay $30 for the privilege. And we were told that we would, none of us could get into Gaza unless we presented this affidavit at the Rafah crossing. And of course, when we finally did arrive, no one asked for it, and I still have it. It's a $30 souvenir with the seal of the U.S. Embassy in Cairo. But again, this was another bureaucratic obstacle which we feel the U.S. collaborated in, again, trying to delay the process. A day or two afterwards, again, cooling our heels in Cairo, we got permission to from the Egyptians at the last minute and drove all night from Cairo to the Rafah crossing on Wednesday. That would have been the 15th, I think. And what we were also told, instead of the 3 days in Gaza that we had planned to stay, we were told that we could stay a maximum of 24 hours. And that if we overstayed that 24 hours, none of us would be allowed to leave the Gaza Strip. Needless to say, that pretty much forced us to abide by that ruling. And we did succeed in getting through. Most of the supplies got through on rented trucks from Cairo, and the rest were walked across, basically, from our buses. We had 5 buses and 7 trucks. And we had a kind of tumultuous welcome in Gaza late at night. We were also delayed at the border so that it would be after dark. And a lot of the people, the many hundreds of people who were waiting on the Gaza side to meet us, you know, waited in the heat outside for us to come. But finally we made it through. And it was very emotional, I can tell you. Not only because we succeeded in cracking the blockade and bringing some relief supplies, but because many of the members of our convoy were Palestinians with family and roots in Gaza. And it was hugely emotional for them to be able to return and visit their families. Many of them had not seen their relatives for years under this blockade. And it was quite an amazing experience when we finally did get in.
Yeah, I should mention that you received the clearance at about 12:30 a.m. after midnight.
That's right.
On July 15th, and you arrived at the crossing at around 6 p.m. That's
the following day, yeah.
The following day, and it took you 4 hours to finally get on buses to enter Gaza at 10 p.m.
That's right.
That's from 12:30 a.m. in the morning.
It was pretty exhausting, I can tell you. As you know, Sharif, Egypt in the summertime is pretty hot.
It's a furnace. It's a furnace.
And so we basically spent 24 hours on the way into Gaza, and sort of spent the night on the bus, and spent the night packing the bus and all day driving, and then it was late at night by the time we reached Rafah, and then an hour or so later, when we got to a place to sleep in Gaza City at the northern part of the Gaza Strip.
Oh, yeah. And you left on the 16th for the long trip to Cairo.
Yep.
And you got here.
Left at night and drove basically all night to get to the airport. People had flights. We left in the evening of the 16th, and many people went directly to the airport. They had flights that morning out that they had to catch and barely caught their flights.
I should also mention that there were many people in El Arish who were there waiting to get into Gaza and were not allowed in Gaza, and they were hoping that they might squeak in with you, fellows.
Yes.
And the Egyptian forces beat them up and brutalized them, abused them and brutalized them, which is unacceptable behavior. Unacceptable.
Yes. You know, the whole situation at the Rafah crossing is heartbreaking. There are people trying to get in from the Egyptian side that are cut off from their relatives. There are people on the Gaza side that are trying to get out. It's totally unpredictable when when the Egyptians will open the border for a brief period of time. And when they do, you know, thousands of people try to get out to go to school, jobs, visit relatives, and usually only a tiny fraction of them succeed. I mean, it's intentionally, it's very much like the Israeli system in the West Bank, where there's just this uncertainty. It's not only that it's closed, but that it's uncertain when it will be open and when not. So it's a horrific scene, and we had some of that tragedy among our own group. We had people, some older people primarily, who were trying to visit family they hadn't seen for years, and we had a real tragedy. People got in. I have friends that I had met were trying to visit their elderly mothers, whom they hadn't seen. In one case, their mother was 90 years old. And in the most, to me, the most heartbreaking case was a middle-aged guy from Kansas City, originally from Gaza, had moved with his family back to Gaza a few years ago. Then he had left to return to his job, expecting his family to follow shortly thereafter. And they became trapped in Gaza. His wife and four young children, who were all U.S. citizens, by the way, were trapped in Gaza and unable to get any permission to leave. He saw them and tried to bring them out with our convoy. Again, I'm emphasizing, these are U.S. citizens trapped in Gaza. And they were stopped at the border by the authorities because they had a list of who the convoy participants were, and these were the only ones who were allowed out. And there was a horrible, heartbreaking scene where this guy, Maher, had to decide what to do just, you know, at the moment. Either he could stay behind in Gaza and be trapped indefinitely with his family, lose his job, or had to leave and leave them behind and continue to work with the U.S. Embassy, if possible, to try to get their permission to leave. And he chose the latter, which was, I think, the only rational thing to do. And his young children and his wife at the border were literally, he was able to cross, and they were held back. And the children were hysterical. Maher himself was in tears. His children were hysterically screaming. And this was our departure from Gaza, and a little bit of the sort of a microcosm of the human tragedy that this blockade is causing.
You mentioned that New York Congressman Charles Barron was there.
City councilor, actually.
New York City councilor. What was his take of all of this? I mean, how did he see it, and what was his reaction, and what do you expect? What can we expect of him from here?
Well, he like other elected officials who really participate in the solidarity movement, is just, you know, unyielding in his efforts to support the rights of the Palestinians and break this blockade. I mean, it was at some personal sacrifice to him to participate in the convoy. You know, it's a pretty controversial activity for a local city councilor from Brooklyn. And he was, you know, functioned as the main spokesperson for us and the main negotiator, U.S. negotiator, along with Galloway and his staff, with the Egyptians and the U.S. Embassy. And I give him huge credit for this. I mean, it's just, and he, some of his staffers came along as well. He participated in the rally, the sort of launching rally in Brooklyn before we actually went to Cairo. And I give him enormous credit. And, of course, Cynthia McKinney as well, who has taken up this cause at great personal sacrifice. It not only cost her her seat in Congress, but she participated in two attempts by sea to break the siege, both of them unsuccessful. In the first case, a year or so ago, her ship was rammed by the Israeli Navy. In the second case, she spent a week in jail in Israel and then turned around and came with us to Cairo. These people deserve enormous credit for this, and they have my heartfelt thanks.
Can we recover the vehicles impounded in Alexandria? Can the Egyptian government be sued here in the United States?
I don't know. I mean, there are very complicated legal issues, and there were some members of the convoy organizers who had stayed behind and were sort of trying to sort these issues out, at least in the first place, to get the vehicles to Gaza, where there's a tremendous shortage of vehicles. You know, they haven't been able to legally import vehicles for a long time, so that there's no transportation for sort of medical purposes in Gaza. It's very difficult for anyone to get around. You have people in wheelchairs trying to get to clinics through rubble-strewn streets, you know, on their own, you know, because there's no transport. So these vehicles are very important and very much desired by the people in Gaza. Whether we can get them out or not is not clear. And, of course, failing that, whether we can get the money back to them and redirect those resources to other forms of relief, we don't know. But it's certainly out of my hands. I can't comment on what the legal issues are.
Mm-hmm.
We did fail to get them and drive them to Gaza, which was the plan. But
We have to note that Egypt explains its position vis-a-vis Gaza this way. If Egypt allowed Palestinians into Egypt, it would make Egypt responsible for Gaza and absolve Israel of its responsibilities as an occupying power. Palestinians would not be able to return home if they left Gaza, and they would be ultimately the losers. So there is some truth in this. If we remember what happened when Palestinians in Gaza broke through the Rafah crossing last year on January 23, 2008, Israel's President Shimon Peres gloatingly remarked that, quote, the responsibility for Gaza is now in the hands of Egypt, unquote. And the Israeli newspaper Arutz Sheva reported that Knesset member Aryeh Eldad hailed the exodus as proof that, quote, voluntary transfer is indeed an option. While this may explain to some extent Egypt's behavior, it does not excuse the abuse and wanton violence of the Egyptian forces toward Gaza's Palestinians, or the obstacles it deliberately imposes on the passing of humanitarian aid into Gaza, and the steps that it took to make sure that the convoy collapsed were shameful indeed. What next steps do you see, Jeff?
Well, my understanding is that George Galloway and others are organizing a third convoy. I should say the precedent for this effort was an overland relief convoy from the UK to Rafah, which did succeed in crossing. It went overland through Spain and then crossed over to North Africa and drove all along North Africa, and eventually, after a lot of opposition, were allowed to proceed into Gaza. I think the Egyptians have decided that they have to, if they're not going to be faced with repeated efforts to break the siege, they have to, you know, do what they can to stop this, and that's the obstacles we met. But there's another plan for an overland convoy through Eastern Europe, Turkey, and then down through Jordan into Gaza that's being organized now. And I don't know the details. But people can check. There are two websites. There's the effort. The whole effort is called Viva Palestina, and there's a British website and a U.S. Viva Palestina -U.S. that will report on these efforts. And I guess they'll be looking for people to participate in the next convoy from Europe. And meanwhile, the Free Gaza movement, which is attempting to break the siege by sea, is continuing to prepare ships from Cyprus. And they also have a website, freegaza.org, and people can follow it, follow that. So there are various ways for people to participate. And also, of course, fundraising is important in order to purchase the relief supplies and pay for the vehicles and so on. So I hope people will check out the progress of these different efforts. Of course, it's largely symbolic. The real effort to break the siege is political, and we need to press our own government to put its actions to its words. You remember President Obama, when he spoke in Cairo, he mentioned specifically the siege of Gaza and urged it being lifted. We didn't see any evidence of that, follow-through of that, when we were there, but I think we need to continually raise this issue and ask our government to provide much-needed relief supplies into Gaza, including for reconstruction, which so far is has been blocked because construction equipment, supplies, concrete are not allowed into the Gaza Strip, so that nothing can be rebuilt that was destroyed by the Israeli attack in December and January of this year.
I expect you will be talking about your trip for a while out here in Greater Boston. And we will keep tabs of your talks and mention them here on this program.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for being our guest today, Jeff Klein.
Thank you, Sharif.
Well, that does it for today. We wish our listeners a pleasant and restful weekend and look forward to having you with us next week, same time. Until then, this is Sharif Fahm signing off for now and reminding our listeners to get involved. Get involved.
لماذا تركت الحصار